major hallucinogenic plant complexes that I've had experience with and can address are, well, let's do a little quick geographical tour. First of all, North America, for reasons not well understood, is quite poor in native hallucinogens. There are no major North American hallucinogens. Peyote is, well, yes, it's North American. The funny thing about peyote, I mean, you can feed me questions as long as we stick to the subject. The thing about peyote is, you know, we have this tremendous respect for it. We imagine that it's tremendously ancient, and it apparently isn't. There is no archaeological evidence of peyote use any earlier than 500 years ago. It's almost a phenomenon of the conquest. What you find in the old graves in the peyote cultural area are the seeds of Sephora secundifolia, which is an ordeal poison, strychnine. And often drug human-plant symbiotic relationships evolve over time. It may be that the use of hallucinogens is still in fairly dynamic evolution all over the planet. Peyote is a major hallucinogen. Should have been used for the past 50,000 years. If it has only been used for the past 500 years, that's pretty peculiar, all right, and yet that appears to be the evidence. Ibogaine, not only a visionary hallucinogen, but an aphrodisiac as well, no evidence of any use before 1850. And yet, in an area where the Portuguese had been trading for the past 500 years and writing cultural descriptions and interviewing the people, I mean, if it was there, it would have been mentioned. This is a puzzle. Ayahuasca use, we assume, is millennia old. But on the other hand, archaeology is a real miserable proposition in the Amazon because the climate is so degradative, so we can't really know. But aside from peyote and whatever its history, North America seems to have only minor hallucinogens that have been utilized shamanically. Another puzzle about culture and attitudes is, as you all know, the Northwest Coast Indians, the Kwakutl, Shimsham, and Tlingit language groups have an extraordinarily evolved shamanism and were the people who developed that X-ray vision style of art. Well, their cultural area has the densest number of psilocybin mushrooms of any place in the world. No cultural evidence of psilocybin use. No evidence that these people even knew these things were there. I mean, I know this challenges the tradition of the all-knowing Aboriginal, but, you know, that this is what the data seems to imply. Now, in Southern California and across portions of the Southwest, there have been Datura religions, which are very old, apparently, the so-called Tlatch religion. I don't recommend Datura. I don't know what astrological sign you have to be to make your peace with that stuff. But I find it really peculiar and menacing. And it's about magic, which is about power and control and usually sexuality in some invasive and dominator application. I've taken Datura a number of times, and it's been interesting, but it feels watery and dark and dangerous to me. There was a period when I lived in Nepal when I became aware that these sadhus, not content with their superior meditation techniques and their endless smoking of hashish, were also availing themselves of the seeds of Datura metal, which is conspecific to what we call Jimson weed. in this country. And so I thought, well, I should take this too and find out what it's about. Well, it was a very odd trip. I sat in my room in Bodenoth, and I would sit and say, nothing is happening, nothing is happening. Well, you can only think that so many times. Then my mind would drift into a kind of twilight state, and then these wraith-like entities, I mean, they were like Victorian ghosts, you know, they were like women in shredded damask gowns or something, would fly into my window carrying newspaper sheets in their outstretched arms, and they would let these sheets of newspaper flutter down onto my lap, and I would like begin to read, and I would begin, and I would be so astonished by what I was reading that it would jerk me out of it, and I'd say, "What's happening? Nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. Nothing's happening." And then my attention would drift, and this would happen again. Well, then after about a half an hour of that, as the stuff began to build up, I began to, like I would undergo these very brief periods of unconsciousness, and when I came out of them, I would discover that my leg had been thrown up around behind my head and my arm shot through, and I was like all knotted up. Then I would very carefully unfold myself and lay back down, and I remember thinking, I'm certainly glad there's nobody else here, because this is the kind of thing just designed to drive a sitter into a conniption fit of alarm. And, you know, about six times over the next hour and a half, I went into these convulsive spasms. And, you know, then on another night, these English people shared a suite of rooms off of mine, and I had to get to the bathroom. I had to go through this one guy's room. So this one night, I hadn't taken Datura, but this fellow had taken Datura, and at one point, I had to go to the John, so I debated for a long time about how this was going to disturb his trip, and maybe I should piss out the window, but no, that didn't seem... Although in India, it's perfectly all right. And... So finally I decided I would just walk through the room. So then as I was tiptoeing through the room, I saw that he was actually having sex with this girl that we knew from Kathmandu. And it had a slight emotional tinge for me because I had actually had my eye on her, although I had never said anything about it to anybody. So then the next morning I mentioned this, and he said that, yes, it had been his impression as well, but that in fact she wasn't there. And so it was like, you know, I saw somebody else's hallucination. And then what finally decided me that Datura was too peculiar was I had another English friend who lived a couple of houses away. And one day I was in the market buying potatoes, and this guy came along, and we were just talking. And in the course of this conversation, he was telling me how he'd been taking a lot of Datura. And in the course of this conversation, I became aware that he thought that I was visiting him in his apartment. And I decided, that's too fucked up, you know, to not know whether you're entertaining someone in the confines of your apartment or buying vegetables in the market means that you have become too disengaged from the modalities of the real. And of course it creates tremendous drying, and deliriant is what the literature calls it. It's a deliriant. But these, you know, I think that people all over the world utilize plants for bizarre experiences. Time and time again, I've run up against this. There's a very rare drug in South America called ukuhe. Ukuhe. It's made by the Witoto and the Bora and the Muinani in this very circumscribed area. And what fascinated us about it was that it was an orally active DMT drug. And we couldn't, as pharmacologists, understand how an orally active DMT drug was possible, because the DMT should be destroyed in your gut. So we wanted to get a sample of this stuff. And it's made from the resin of Varola trees. The inner bark of the Varola sheds a red resin. And we eventually, in 1981, my brother and I and Wade Davis, the guy who wrote The Serpent and the Rainbow, we all launched an expedition up the Rio Yaguas Yasu, and where there was this stuff. And we would do what we called bioassays, which means somebody has to test this stuff, because we would get samples from these shaman, and we would draw straws to for who got to do the bioassay. Well, taking this ukuhe was appalling. I mean, your heart rate goes up to about 3 times normal. You shed water by the gallon. Your blood pressure shoots up. I mean, it felt like a pre-coronary to me. And then we come down and say to this shaman, you know, Lorenzio, what's the story? And he said, yeah, it takes getting used to, doesn't it? And then when you look at it, when you look at this ukuhe chemically, you see, well, yes, there's DMT in there. And there's 5-MAO DMT in there. But then, when you do the gas chromatogram, you see that marching along behind those spots are all these other spots of various tryptamine compounds, some of which are cardioregulators, some of which nobody knows what they do. And so then you realize that it's a dirty drug. There's too much junk in there. What you want is something that has a very clean signature. So ukuhe didn't exactly seem the way to go. I think that this is the real situation with Amanita muscaria. Probably the most discussed, uninteresting drug in the world, because so many people have tried to hang so much on it. And, you know, it's a horrible experience most of the time. I mean,
it has a toxic level real close to
Yeah. And occasionally you'll meet someone who says, well, you're just wrong. It's wonderful. I've taken it for years. I love it. And I, you know, don't know. First of all, it's genetically variable. It's geographically variable. It's seasonally variable. And it fluctuates at various times in its process of maturation. So what must be going on with Amanita muscaria is you have to learn how to take it in your area from people who know where to collect it, when to collect it, how much to collect, and how to prepare it. But if you just go out and find one and chow down, I guarantee you it'll turn you every way but loose, and then it'll turn you loose. So,
but have you done it by drinking urine?
No, that's what they always say. They say, have you drunk your urine recently? I got a letter last week. No, I understand that it, do you all understand the basis of the question? Why does urine come into it? Because, in Siberia, they have discovered, which is where this Amanita thing originates, that the active principle is not destroyed inside your body, that it is excreted in the urine. And the true aficionados of this stuff believe that the so-called second pass is better than the first pass. And so you have to, you know, they drink the urine. One of the great hazards of Siberian shamanism is stepping outside of the yurt on a snowy night to take a leak and being pitched head first into the snow by frantic reindeer who will butt you out of the way to try to get to the yellow snow, because they're so completely hooked on Amanita that nothing stands in their way of this stuff.
I thought you were going to say that it's your students.
Oh, your students pushing you out of them. Well, I've never hung out with the Yakuts. Maybe they are a pretty wild-eyed gang. An example of how a very ancient folkway can be incorporated into our culture without us even realizing it, and is provided by discussing Amanita muscaria. If you go to the Encyclopedia Britannica and you look up Santa Claus, they'll tell you that it has to do with St. Nicholas, and it got started in the 11th century. But when you look at the Santa Claus story, it's a perfect mythologem to analyze from this point of view, because look what's going on with Santa Claus. First of all, Santa Claus's colors are red and white, the colors of the Amanita muscaria, for sure. Santa Claus lives at the North Pole. What does this mean? It means that Santa Claus lives at the Axis Mundi, where Yggdrasil, the magic world ash of Welsh mythology, has taken root. Santa Claus flies. This is what shamans do. Santa Claus is the master of the reindeer, the animal most associated with the Amanita muscaria. Santa Claus is aided in his work by troops of elves. And what is the work of Santa Claus? To build toys for children. Remember the DMT thing, saying, look at this, look at this. Well, those were off-duty elves, clearly. So here are all the motifs. And I believe that for children in our culture, that all the Christer stuff is not what Christmas is about. Christmas is about standing in front of the tree on Christmas morning with the gifts arrayed and the twinkling lights on. Well, that tree is the tree that the Amanita muscaria forms its symbiotic relationship to. It's always spruce or pine that it has a mycorrhizal relationship to. So the number of motifs relating Santa Claus to a cult of Amanita muscaria, there's almost nothing but relational motifs there. And yet if you suggest this to people, they just back away in horror, you know. Well, these hallucinogenic plants seem clustered in the New World in two areas. The first area is the Sierra Mazateca of central Mexico and related areas. And there you have a number of things overlapping. You have a mushroom area of multiple species where, unlike the Kwakutl Shimsham Tlingit language area, in this central Mexican language area, they absolutely did use and discover these mushrooms. And we have these things called mushroom stones that go 2500 BC. So the mushroom religion is truly archaic in Mexico. In the same cultural area, you have the morning glory seeds that come from Ipomoea purpura and related hybrids. Are you all familiar with these? This is a psychedelic plant that you can grow yourself and take. Don't buy the packages of seeds and take them, because a benevolent government has made sure that they are soaked in horrendous poison so that you can't get loaded on them. But you can grow a crop out of them that will be toxin-free. And this is a tremendous visionary intoxicant. It takes a couple of hundred of these seeds. But in that same area, strangely enough, there's another morning glory, Turbina corymbosa. It used to be called Rivia corymbosa, that as few as 13 seeds will flatten you. Now, it's interesting, as long as we're talking about morning glory seeds, to note that per unit volume, by weight, probably the strongest plant hallucinogen in the world is Hawaiian baby woodrose. And yet there is no record of any culture ever utilizing that. There are 13 species of Argyrea. It's called Hawaiian baby woodrose, but it has nothing to do with Hawaii. It's native to India. There are 13 species of Argyrea scattered from southern India out to Fiji, and all contain ergot-like LSD. Like compounds, like chinoclavine and so forth. These, I got started on Morning Glory seeds because they were available. But don't sell this stuff short, folks. I mean, it'll give you a ride that you'll never forget. And the baby woodrose, even more so, be very careful with the Hawaiian baby woodrose because it contains cardioactive glycosides. And, you know, if you, you know, maybe 6 seeds will do you. 12 seeds might well plant you. And 12 seeds will fit on a tablespoon. So this is nothing to start choking down in large amounts. Yeah.
Are those cardioactive glycosides?
Yes, and could be extracted in a fairly simple filtration system. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Morning glory seeds can be dried. Do you grind them up?
Well, they are dry. They're little crescent-shaped dry things. Yeah, grind them in a brawn grinder and...
mix them with anything? Water? Soda.
Applesauce is the favorite carrier for these disgusting things, or milkshakes. But it would be good to look into doing a little chemistry. The emetic in the Morning Glories is ester coumarone. Not the cardioactive glycoside in Argyrea nervosa, but in Ipomea purpura, it's ester coumarone. And you could devise a simple chemical system for removing that. And I think LSD, you know, have you ever had what's called Woodrose LSD? Well, it's wonderful. It's unlike LSD. It's more like psilocybin because it is highly visionary. And one of the things about these Morning Glories is, you know, I don't know whether we have to talk about Rupert's theory or what, but it is just an archive of Mayan and Toltec imagery. I mean, you take this stuff and you're there in the pyramidal complex on the day of Venus's heliacal rising when they do their thing. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Isn't the active ingredient lysergic acid eflamide?
It's a close relative. It's active not in the microgram range, but in the milligram range. And there are several active compounds. You're right, and I think chinoclavine is psychoactive, and ergonovine, all these occur there.
So do you grind those and swallow them whole or make an infusion?
No, you grind them to a powder and then just take it. Capsule, it's a lot of capsules. It's like half a cup of this horrible whitish meal with a strange smell. But yeah, basically about 200 seeds. You may want to go higher, but start with that. Yeah.
Well, now, supposedly in the Massatet area, the Rubea carabosa seeds are ground up and then they are put into a cold water to make a cold water infusion. And then the solids are removed so that there's only a water-soluble fraction in the water. And then that is drunk.
Well, no, but if what you're saying is true, that's where the glycoside would reside. That's not my understanding, actually. What?
Well, I just remember a picture of a woman doing that in a book like by Schultz.
Well, maybe the caption got mislabeled or something, because the way they do it where I've seen it is they take the little seeds and they grind them on a matate to powder. Then they put it in water, as you said, and they shake it and leave it and come back an hour later and shake it again and do that for a while. And then the stuff precipitates to the bottom, the matter, and the liquid fraction is poured off and discarded. And they take the solid matter and they let it dry in the sun until it's no longer runny, but it's a kind of like the consistency of oatmeal or Play-Doh or something like that, and then they make a little tiny tortilla, which they then toast on a metal griddle, and so you get this thing which looks slightly smaller than a Ritz cracker, and is a toasted Morning Glory seed wafer, and you eat that, and that is the thing which is active. That's how I've seen it done. Apparently not. They toast it lightly. They don't. It's not blackened. It's just sort of golden.
Is this the Morning Glory seeds,
or is that the wine? No, it's one species of Morning Glory, Turbina, previously called Revea coriambosa. The other one, the Morning Glory that you have to take a couple of hundred seeds for, is used in that area as a hallucinogen, but it's also used to induce labor and has a whole role in midwifery and like that.
Okay, because I got confused. I thought we were talking about this cardiovascular regulator.
No, that's the Hawaiian wood rose, and it has no history of human usage, so you're on your own. This is, it's worth talking about maybe for a minute that, you know, there are, hallucinogens are like hotel rooms. Some are occupied and some are not. And it's always interesting to fiddle with the unoccupied ones, because if you believe Sheldrake, then it's an empty field. You know, one way of thinking of these things is when you take a plant, it takes you. So when you take mushrooms, for instance, what the trip is all the mushroom trips that anybody ever had. And you leave, you know, you make a tiny contribution too. It's, you leave a piece of your trip in the trip. And so the trip is slowly evolving over time as those who take the plant each leaves a brick or an offering or a little architectural motif on this vast edifice. Well, then if you come, that was why, you know, a plant like Hawaiian woodrose, or to some degree Stropharia cubensis, because it is not the preferred mushroom among the Mexican traditionalists, then it's unoccupied. You can make of it what you want. It can be sort of your vehicle. This is why, you know, a drug like ketamine, which is a new drug, a drug without 1,000 years of input. My impression of where you go on ketamine is it's like visiting a new office building that nobody has rented offices yet. I mean, all the water coolers work, and there are these recessional distances with fluorescent lighting. But, you know, there are no hurrying secretaries and crowded offices and chatter around the water fountains. It's just empty. It's empty because not enough people have left their initials on the walls. Yeah.
What is the variety that's common, mushroom that's common in the Yucatan, in the Mayan area?
Well, if you mean growing on manure.
Yeah,
that's Stropharia cubensis. See, there are about 30 species of mushrooms that grow in that Mexican area, and most of them are what are called, well, not most, some are ephemeral mushrooms, meaning they're very small and they can be almost anywhere. And then there are some larger ones too that can be almost anywhere. Stropharia cubensis is the only one of the good ones that locates on cow dung. Now, there are other mushrooms which grow on cow dung that contain psilocybin, but they also are more sickening. There are species of Paniolus and species of Caprinus. If you collect a mushroom off dung and you want to know whether it's a Paniolus or a Caprinus or a Stropharia, just keep it around for a few hours. If it's a Stropharia, it will just sort of be around. If it's a Caprinus or a Paniolus, it will do what's called autodigest. It will turn into a slimy mess. And
do you tell from spore print?
No, you can't tell from the spore print, but you can tell from the macro morphology of it if you know mushrooms. They're easy to tell apart.
Things that have the spore print, I don't have mushrooms.
Yeah, well, that's tricky. You need somebody who really knows their stuff.
I just need to clarify one thing. Were you implying that there was a way to, like a similar water process for the Hawaiian wood rose seeds to remove the stuff?
It was more speculative, but I think it would be worth trying.
But I thought that the urgent alkaloid was water soluble.
Some are and some aren't.
But it's the one that's the water soluble.
I'm not sure about that. I've read some more about synthesizing LSD, and it's apparently hard to get to the starting points. I heard if you get a bunch of morning glory seeds and soak in lighter fluids, what I heard, that gets you halfway there, and then you get it from there.
Yeah, that sounds right. PET ether is a good one. So is chloroform. Have any of you read The Road to Eleusis?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That's about the Eleusinian mysteries and argues, it's by Wasson and Hoffman and Ruck, and argues that the mystery at Eleusis was a kind of ergotized beer, that they were gathering ergot off Paspalum and making an ergotized beer. And the only way they could have done that for 2,000 years, stoning thousands of people each September at this cult site without the thing getting a reputation for being toxic or causing convulsions, is if they had some way that was very efficient of separating the dangerous alkaloids from the hallucinogenic ones. So that may have been a water fractionation technique as well. Or, you know, the whole theory may be wrong, and whatever was drunk at Eleusis may not have been ergotized beer. It could have been a mushroom of some sort. This is what Robert Graves thought, that it was a mushroom.
Is that book back in print yet?
The Road to Eleusis? Probably not, because Wasson is now dead, and the estate is kind of funny about that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Two questions. One of them, could you talk more about the emetic in morning glory and how to get rid of that?
The emetic is ester coumarone. If you're not a chemist and used to dealing with high molecular weight solvents, then you should do some kind of a water, dissolve it in water and then try to separate out the fractions. This would be, I think a lot of work needs to be done. I think in the underground there are publications which have circulated that are, you know, the wizard's workbook for mushroom for morning glory reclamation and stuff like this. You pay your dues with morning glories, but it's usually worth the price of admission. It's just nausea, after all, for crying out loud.
The second question had to do with what you were saying about different hallucinogens and hotel rooms. I got the impression that the implication is that somehow consciousness creates the reality that's put, you know, that's out there, depending on whether how often consciousness has used these different hallucinogens. Is that...
I think so. I mean, that we leave our fingerprints upon the drugs we take, and drugs that have been taken for thousands of years have a lot of fingerprints on them, and you join up with that. You enter into the field, you know. One way of thinking, since somebody talked about Sheldrake earlier, one way of thinking about psychedelics in trying to define what do they do is that they are amplifiers of the morphogenetic field. That, you know, the past of objects somehow becomes present. This would fit in with my notion that when you take a psychedelic, you are rising into some kind of superspace that can be mathematically described, because having the past be co-present with the present is a way of saying that you have shifted your dimensional relationship to the data field, and now it all appears to be one coherent thing. Yeah.
What is the plant that grows in the southwest that has harmala in it?
Pagaman harmala, the giant Syrian rue. Its original range is from Morocco to Manchuria, but at some time in the 19th century it was brought into this country as a range fodder for goats. I mean, it's a pretty rasty plant. It has small yellow flowers, and it's a kind of, it has succulent leaves, sort of water-holding leaves, and it looks like a form of sagebrush. And when you cut into it with a knife or a machete, it's brilliant yellow inside. And that brilliant yellow is the harmine. Pound it up with a sledgehammer to separate the fibers and do a hot water wash on it, and then, you know, do a second hot water wash, then get rid of the physical stuff, combine the two mother liquors and drive it down to a reasonable volume, and it'll do the trick. Yeah.
You're probably familiar with a couple of different books by Allegro and Puharich.
John Allegro and Andrzej Puharich, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what's your assessment? Do you think there's any value of the theories in the
ministry? Well, not to rain on anybody's parade, Andrzej Puharich is a very mercurial person. Is that what we want to say? Recall that he was the guy who pushed Uri Geller for a long time, and they were forever tromping into the Negev and coming out with blank cassettes that had held the wisdom of the galaxy, but the aliens erased them before they let them return. That could happen here. So that's Andrzej Puharich. He's been around for a long time. I mean, you have to, these people are such eccentrics. I mean, you have to just respect people's persistence and survival power. But I think, you know, his scholarship and his notion of the rules of evidence is fairly divergent, even from my fairly loose canon. So Allegro is a little different case. Do you all know the book The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross? He managed to hypothesize one of the most radical theories ever to come down the pike. I don't know how true it is, but his theory is that Jesus was a mushroom. And, you know, this would not probably have cut too much mustard, except that the guy was a Dead Sea Scroll scholar of world renown, had a scholar's grasp of Aramaic and Akkadian, and was fully licensed to be one of the people who tell us what the primary documents of Christianity really mean. The problem was, when Allegro got a hold of them, he said, well, what they really mean is that a sacramental mushroom was being grown in caves by Nabataeans down around Qumran, and they called it Jesus in order to befuddle the Roman authorities, and created the cheerful theory of the friendly carpenter who tells us to render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. And this was all a publicity stunt just to keep the Roman authorities guessing. And he has textual, he claims he has textual support for this. The problem is, you have to be an Aramaic philologist to follow the argument. I mean, the argument is unbelievably tortured. There is a lot of question. There is a peculiar opaqueness about the early history of Christianity. I mean, if we are to try and take it seriously and understand what happened there, then it must be that, first of all, if we believe Christ was a real person, then he must have been born in 6 BC, because there was a conjunctio maxima of Jupiter and Saturn at that time, which is a good astrological event to hang the nativity on, which means then that the crucifixion would have occurred in 27. Well, why is it then that there are no mentions, no mention of Christ can be pushed back later than earlier than AD 69? What was going on between 27 and 69? The Gospels are not contemporaneous. And the mention in 69 is not even a sure thing. It's in Suetonius. And he says, Jews have recently come to Rome agitating in the name of their leader Crispus. And that's the reference. And, you know, it's puzzling. Because take a figure as minor as Mani. Mani is the founder of Manichaeanism. He was born in Seleucia Ctesiphon in the 700s. Well, God, we have Mani's laundry bills. I mean, we know how much he paid in taxes, the nickname he had for his dog. I mean, we have a lot of data on Mani, and so why a figure like Christ should be so peculiarly swathed in ambiguity if it was a real person with these people eager to chronicle it is a little hard to figure out.
Didn't Mani have a big religion going in his own lifetime? I mean, kind of a big organization. Of course, Christ has had 12.
Yeah, I mean, Mani got right with it. I mean, he cultivated the court. He knew how to get his thing going, yeah. If any of you are interested in these kinds of questions and like your data in novel form, read The Transmigration of Timothy Archer by Philip K. Dick, which is a wonderful intellectual romp through all of these issues. It's essentially the fictional telling of the story of James Pike, who you may remember was the Episcopal Bishop of San Francisco and a great enthusiast for LSD. And he died in the Negev under very mysterious conditions. He parked his car and with a roadside map and a bottle of Coca-Cola in 115 degree heat, started walking toward the sea, the Dead Sea, and dehydrated and died. And he was very close to John Allegro. You know, I'm not given to conspiracy theory, but you must have been following this whole hassle about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, a lot of people think it's because what is written there is incommensurate with Christianity as it has existed for 1700 years, and nobody knows what to do with this stuff. I mean, it's the equivalent of what do you do with the doctrine of the resurrection if somebody comes up with the mummy of Christ? Well, that's the kind of situation that these Dead Sea Scrolls may place Christian hermeneutics in. John Allegro's book? No, John Allegro died recently. Sacred Mushroom. Oh no. The book by Philip K. Dick is called The Transmigration of Timothy Archer. Yeah.
Are you aware of Edmund Bordozeki's translations?
Oh, yes. He's another one.
And what his really tweaking volume was called How the Great Pan Died.
Right.
And it was an expose of Jesus Barabbas versus this supposed Jesus. And so it's, yeah.
Yes, well, the empire never died, which is Philip K. Dick's motto. The Gnostic temperament is alive and well. In fact, there hasn't been a century as friendly to Gnosticism as the 20th since the 4th. So there you have it.
I've read a little bit of Revelations, and it sounds like a description of a purgatory.
Well, this has been suggested. What you need to, you know, to put the Gospel of John in context, get Charles's book, The Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha of the New Testament.